I mean, I had a really, really great time. I honestly thought I was just coming over for a kind of Brooklyn brunch with my friend Loiso, and then all these amazing people turned up.
Yeah, you know, that's what happens when you're us, Gail. We just gotta get used to it now. CEOs and world leaders just wanna show up and jump on our bill. They really like, oh my god, aren't you on that podcast? I save babies! I'm like, yeah, you do.
Hi, I'm Loiso Madinga.
And I'm Gail Galley.
And this is a special bonus series of An Idiot's Guide to Saving the World, the podcast for anyone who cares about building a better world but doesn't know where to start.
We are on a mission to get everyone on board to achieve the global goals. Now, these are the 17 goals that the world promised to deliver by 2030. So we've spent the last two series exploring what they are, how we can get involved, and what needs to change. But now that we're officially halfway to the deadline, but not halfway to achieving them, we really need some bright ideas for the future.
So, recently, we held an event in New York City where we invited some incredible politicians, filmmakers, business leaders, and activists to share some thoughts on how we can steal the win in the second half.
And it was a really great event. So over the next few episodes of season 3, we're going to be chatting to them again to get everyone as inspired as we were then.
I can't wait for everyone to hear the conversations we had.
Today we're going to meet two politicians. The first, Mary Robinson, who was the president of Ireland during the 1990s and continues to be a passionate activist for climate justice.
And I see women's leadership as being vital now to how we make this transformative change that we've got to make in order to be on course for a safe world for our children and grandchildren and their children and grandchildren.
And Chiyose, the youngest council member of New York City. At 25 years old, he is already serving his second term and making change for good.
I think a lot of young people are dealing with a multitude of different crises, environmental crisis, student debt. So I think that those who are closest to the problems are always the individuals who are closest to the solutions.
Hi, Gail.
Hi, Loiso. How are you?
I am competent today. I'm feeling competent.
Competent enough to be a leader? We're talking about leadership in this episode.
No, not leading myself. I'm willing to be led well.
What do you call yourself a leader? Do you know, like at school reports, I've never had it said about me, but I've seen other people's school reports. They say, you know, really good natural born leader, etc.
No.
Are you not?
No. Loiso is distracting the class. Yeah, I wasn't leading anyone but into temptation, which is not the conversation we're having today. Today we're talking about bold leadership.
We are talking to people who have stepped up into politics. And I mean, I've worked in politics, not as a politician, but I do get asked now kind of regularly. I think I was sort of a leader, by which I think I was bossy. And that I get asked quite often, would you go into politics as a sort of politician? And I'm like, absolutely not.
The times are crazy. And so people look at things and go, what brand of crazy can solve this crazy problem? Because it's like, we're not going to have reasonable people solve it, is the like paradigm of it. If you come and be reasonable, you're the first person to get shot down. If you come
in I don't know. Fancy saying that. Yeah. Fancy, I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, you can't say you're not sure. You can't say, I think we'll try it and see the results. It's this will be done, and this is what the results will be, and everybody will be saved because the left and the right are absolutely incredibly wrong. We need new blood. We need new leadership and good leaders. I think good leaders right now are the kind of people not who tell us what to do necessarily, but the kind of people who can rally people around a good idea and not necessarily have the right answers themselves, but actually be able to like pull in the people and ignite movement from people in the right direction.
I think that's a really good point you make there, because when you think of leader, A, you think of a man, probably a white man, sort of on his own, in a suit, on stage somewhere, pointing at you and telling you what to do. that's like, there's a leader. You know, let's go, ideally from an English public school. There's leadership.
Straight white men have had the best branding.
They really have, as leaders. They haven't got us into a terribly good place, though. But I like that that a leader, the job of a leader is to corral people around a good idea.
That's what I believe. Like, I think a lot of the time people claim to have answers, and I'm always very wary of a politician who claims to have answers or people who speak very definitely about things. Whereas I think since everything takes time, you have to prove that you can guide us through that time. We've bought into that idea of the big leader on top of the hill then we think, oh, that's the person who did the whole thing. And it's like, no, he was just the leader of hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of people who actually made something happen. But we've lost sight of the idea of a people, and we keep trying to find a person.
You're full of depth today, Louisa.
When I finally wake up, when the coffee kicks, my friend, it kicks me in the nuts.
I love the depth now. We've got to find our people. Well, look, we've got, I think, two amazing leaders on our episode today, both of whom would fit that mold, I would say, of being leaders with their people, right? Not of their people, but with their people. So we've got Mary Robinson first. So she was the former president of Ireland. She was the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. And she was a chair of the Elders, which was a group of independent global leaders founded by none other than Nelson Mandela in 2007. And they work towards peace building and justice.
Why don't you tell me she works for Gandalf too? That is quite a resume.
I think she does.
When we met Mary in New York, she was like also just like high energy. Like she has the wisdom of the years and she has the youthful energy to get on stage and just dance. She got up and danced.
She is fantastic.
And you got to speak to her again
for this episode. I did. And she was just as full of beans and just as brilliant. So let's have a listen to our conversation.
I am very motivated by a strong sense of justice, and there's a lot of injustice in the world, including in the climate area. And so I need to keep going because I need to keep fighting that.
Well, I'm sure you're doing the same for a lot of us as well. Certainly for me, when we first met, we were hosting a dinner in New York, and I think we were your seventh, I think, event of the of that day. And I think almost to keep yourself awake, you didn't just stand up, you almost danced, I think, is my memory. So it's clearly working.
I have a tendency to want to dance, yeah, at a certain stage.
Maybe that's the answer. Maybe that is the... I'm a dancer too. I love dance. So maybe that's the answer. Well, let's start with COP. With a bit of time behind it, what's your reflection? How did you think it went?
I think it was a very important COP. Again, because we don't have time anymore. The science is telling us very compellingly that we have to peak global greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. We have to reduce by 43% by 2030. And at the moment, our projections is we're on course for increasing by 9%. So this COP was really important to try and change that direction. And that's why we fought so hard to phase out fossil fuel. And I was aware, I think some people were surprised, but I was aware that we'd never had fossil fuel mentioned as words in a COP before.
That was news to me. Extraordinary.
Yeah, I actually knew that. I knew that and felt very strongly about it. And so I kept repeating, phase out fossil fuel. Okay, so we got... moving down from reducing the kind of weaker words. But we know that we're on a journey out of fossil fuel now. The question is how quickly. I think we've got a chance to push hard because the next COP is the COP about finance in Azerbaijan, in Baku. Not an ideal place, another petrostate. But the main thing is we have movement on realizing we have to enlarge hugely the amount of money that countries need to do what we're asking for, particularly developing countries. You know, one of the gains was to triple renewable energy, really exciting, and double energy efficiency. But we need the capital to do that for developing countries. So we need extraordinary money now available to help shorten the time and make them leapfrog into renewable energy in a really significant way, including at grassroots, including clean cooking. I'm a great fan of, you know, distributive small grids of energy to help African and Asian countries to move their grassroots into switching the switch for electricity. And then they're on the move.
Yeah, I think those are the granular details that are often missed at these big moments, aren't they? Because it's quite, it's complicated, small issues within domestic settings. But that is, the, as you say, en masse, the only thing that we're going to do. I had that experience of arriving in a petrochemical state, feeling a bit dislocated, feeling a little bit, oh, have I done the right thing almost by coming? You know, how's this going to roll? I always feel like that when I get to big conferences. You might even still feel the same of why are we here. And then that excerpt from your previous interview with the COP president, Al Jaber, made more headlines than perhaps it had done the first time.
Get your facts straight, ma'am.
No, no, I understand that. I know that about the UAE. But what I was, Are you saying that I was mistaken in saying that you're going to invest in fossil fuel? Are you not going to invest in new fossil fuel? Because it's good to clarify. If that is untrue, I'll accept it from you.
Ma'am, what is not true is what you said. That we're doubling capacity. We're not doubling capacity. That's number one.
I didn't say double capacity.
What it struck me as was another example of how you are able, and you have always been able, to lean into quite tricky conversations and yet remain very nice, you know, very firm. And that is not taken for granted, I think, by most people. You know, most people find that very difficult. How do you do that? Is that something you just came out being able to do, or have you honed that over the years?
I think I am aware when I'm in a conversation that really matters that I want to get out of it what I can. So I'm usually aware that it doesn't matter if somebody gets angry with my questioning. The point is, can I get enough out of that to be truth to power, I suppose? And the conversation with Sultan Al-Jaber was part of a public women leaders summit, which I was very enthusiastic about. I was able to invite him to it when we met in Beijing. I told him that women leaders also needed to be, you know, taken seriously. And he said, oh, you know, there's lots for women to do. There's the gender day. And I said, well, you know, we want women leaders to be in a very significant way. And we have this virtual summit. And he said, well, if you organize it, I'm very happy. I'll be there. And I was very happy about that. So I knew that we were going to have the conversation, and I was very keen that I would ask the right questions, which were, was he personally going to support phasing out fossil fuel? I kind of knew in advance he wasn't. And so that was a tricky one. And I was aware that the question was going to annoy him. So I nonetheless wanted to ask the question because it was highly relevant. He was the president of the COP. He was a bit compromised because of his position as head of the Abu Dhabi oil and gas company. And with that company, I knew from reports that it was going to increase its profits hugely over the next few years. So it was going against what I was asking. Was he going to phase down? But nonetheless, or phase out, it was important to ask. And the very fact that he was very testy just gave it more momentum. But it wasn't a private conversation. I mean, there were 500 people or so online listening to it, and it went on YouTube. But frankly, I did underestimate that it would have that impact. I wrote to him afterwards to have a meeting at the COP. And I was very clear when we did meet, not to go back over that conversation, but to see how together we can make progress. You know, you work with what you've got, and you try to make as much progress as possible. And I wanted this COP to have the best result possible, even though it would be difficult.
Okay, so I've learned a lesson there, which is focus on the end goal. Even if you know in advance the conversation might get a bit rocky at times, or testy was your word, wasn't it? If you focus on the end goal, that helps you through the sort of awkward moments. In terms of leadership, because you've embodied so many different forms of it and for so many different causes, and we are gathering this podcast series together because we're thinking about the global goals, the fact that we have only now 6 years to make the progress we need, what forms of leadership is it going to take to get us there? And I was just wondering personally for you, what are you leading for now and next? And within that, do feel free to explain Project Dandelion, because that was news to me at the when we first met, but it looks like a really terrific new tactic for the second half.
I'm passionate about women's leadership, and I see women's leadership as being vital now to how we make this transformative change that we've got to make in order to be on course for a safe world for our children and grandchildren and their children and grandchildren. So it's really, really important. And I've been linking with women leaders, and we've had a sort of moonshot idea. But when I first talked about moonshot and talked about John F. Kennedy, I got a lot of pushback from my women leader friends. They said, no, that's male and military. That's not for us. Come back with a feminist way of saying that. And I didn't do it all on my own, but we found the dandelion, the only flower or weed that grows on all continents. It's very resilient. You can't get rid of the damn thing if you want to. And until recently, I was included in that. Now I love the dandelion. It's a beautiful flower. And it's very regenerative of the soil. The roots are very deep. You can eat or drink every part of the dandelion. And even the roots take toxins out of the human body. And how do you spread it? Children, blow the seed. So we want We want to connect in a communicating the right messages about climate, that it's on our watch, that actually we can, especially as women leaders, very much play our part and we can make this transformative change. And it's really a matter of what if our best times are ahead of us, is what we often say. They are, because our best times are when we have achieved the sustainable development goals. We'll have a much healthier world. It'll be a much fairer, more equal world. And it's just around the corner. And we are seeing now the tripling of renewable energy, which is part of that, but only part of it. And what is against us is a very powerful communications lobby. It spends about $4 billion every year. So Project Dandelion, it's like David against Goliath. We have a tiny, tiny budget. And actually, it's hard to get a budget for a movement. But actually, you know, foundations should understand it's the movement that's going to make a difference. It made a difference at the Paris Agreement, the movement in the street for 1.5, and the movement inside of Tony de Broom of the Marshall Islands working with the High Ambition Coalition got that wording into the text. It wouldn't have happened without the big movement of indigenous, young, progressive business, scientists, artists, religious leaders, the whole lot.
What is it about women, and this is a big question, but just, you know, there'll be a lot of women listening to this thinking like, yes, and I think I can help. But just help explain a bit how you see the intersectionality of women with all of these other issues that you're leading for.
That's a really good question, because that was actually fundamental to my relationship with the women leaders group. They're called Connected Women Leaders, and they were interested in the connection between health, food security and climate change. And I converted them to climate justice a few years before our more recent conversation about the urgency of needing this moonshot approach, the Project Dandelion approach. But it's all about the intersectionality. And I'm aware that one of our first things is to reach out beyond the climate world, those who go to COPs and those who follow what happens at COPs, way beyond that, to women who work on girls' education, on Me Too issues, on violence against women, on health issues, and say, no matter what you're working on now, prioritise the climate crisis, because it's undermining your work. You know it. You don't have to be an expert on climate. Just talk about how your work is being undermined by these shocks that are coming to your country, the floods, the fires, the drought, etc. And the effect on driving girls into early child marriage, or the effect, you know, talk about the effects in your own work. And then you become a powerful voice with us. It's not just a narrow climate and nature conversation, important as that is. It's a conversation that totally takes in the intersectionality. And I think women really understand that.
You know, we're very early days of this civilization. We're kind of only a few hundred years in, and we got it wrong. You know, we've made a few missteps, one of which is separating from nature. Imagine what it's going to look like when we figure it out and we get it right again. That'll be amazing.
We'll do it quicker if we use the whole of the leadership that's available in human beings, not the half that is men-led now, but actually have a real conscious effort to have women in there at all of the decision tables. We'll have less wars, we'll have less testosterone-led stupid decisions, of which we have quite a lot, and so on. I mean, you know, women's leadership is vital to us moving forward in the world. And I mean women in the fullest sense.
What gives you hope when you think about the journey ahead? And, you know, we've talked about it needs to be fast and it needs to be, you know, powerful and pretty dramatic, really, the shifts that we need to happen. What gives you hope that we're going to get there?
I think young people give me a lot of hope, because despite the fact that they are facing a much more difficult world, they are very determined and they're very aware of the injustice of climate change. I mean, the fact that climate justice has become so accepted now. When I started, it was a niche term. A few of us were using it, but it wasn't generally accepted in the UN system. And now everybody who cares marches for climate justice and sees the injustices, the layers of injustice. And I find that very, I mean, the elders do a lot of intergenerational conversation. And we say, and it's true, we learn as much as we offer as mentors. We're mentored as well, because these young people are smart, they're connected, they care about those more vulnerable than they are. They talk about being part of a world, you know, that you know, is not a world of nations in a narrow sense. It's a world that has to come together on these global issues.
I think that that climate justice is a real win, and in a really short amount of time. Because I can remember in my relatively short, but I've been going at this for about 8 years, halfway through the Goals campaign, I remember that term first coming in, and I remember not understanding it. So as in absolutely central to one of the more sort of established movements, there was an understanding of climate justice. And now I totally understand it. And now, you know, fully on board. And if we can change those sorts of things, then maybe we can speed up, you know, speed up some other areas to progress upon. Of all the things that you feel you've managed to achieve, accepting that the best is ahead of us, but of all the things so far that you've achieved, what is the thing that you're most proud of? Not, if not solving, moving forward to a better place?
You know, I can't even answer the question because I don't think in those terms. I think in terms of I'm always moving on to where we need to be next, rather than thinking in terms of what have I done that's been achievement or something. I don't think in those terms, to be honest.
I think you think that you get excited, though, by what's to come, as opposed to, oh my God, what have I got to do next? You know, whenever I hear you or see you in action, it feels like you're driven by a sense of, you know, pleasure and excitement at the opportunity to change the world for the better.
Very much so. And really the privilege of doing it, and never on my own. I'm always aware, everything you do, it's because you have a team with you, because you have, you know, when I was elected, people had trust and elected me. Now with the elders, there's a great team that helps me to be a little cleverer than I might otherwise be, and so on. You never, you know, if you think you're doing things on your own, you're fooling yourself. It's very much how you work with others, work with a team, lead by, you know, serving those who believe in you and who trust you, and being aware of how to work together. That's probably why I never talk about achievements, because it's never something about me. It's about what we did together.
Oh, that's a really lovely way of summing it up. And also, I think, lead like a dandelion. That's what I'm taking out of this. Lead lightly and resiliently.
Well, yeah, I'll give you a little plus there because you deserve it. Some of us don't say just, I am a dandelion. Some of us say, I am a dandelioness. And you know what that means?
That is good. That is great.
I look forward
to seeing the next iteration of dandelionesses. I love Mary. I literally love her.
But it's also very easy to be in her position when you have that accent that will sound positive about absolutely anything. I mean, like, you could give the worst news. The world is ending tomorrow. And everyone would be like, yeah, you know what? It sounds like it should probably. I'm okay with it. But the fact that she lays real positive wisdom on top of it is just, you know, it just gives you that extra boost. I mean, that idea of you're not doing any of it alone. Sounds like a cliche, but it's something that you have to be aware of sometimes, because you, even when you feel like you're alone, there's no way you're doing it alone, or you're missing the opportunity to do it with others. That idea of, like, just getting involved already means you're with other people, and that's something you kind of have to always be cognizant of and go back to. It's like, it's not a lonely road.
That's so true. And she also has that sense of it's not lonely, nor is it a big ego play. Like, she couldn't even, did you hear? She couldn't even answer when I said, what are you most proud of? She's like, well, how could I be proud of anything? It's a team game. I think she's just quite extraordinary. I want her in my second half. Anyway, we're halfway through the podcast, which is fitting because we are halfway to the global goals. Now, if we were halfway through a match and we wanted to win in the second half, you're more sporty than I am. What would you add for the second half?
Fresh legs. The freshest legs you have. Just bursting with energy in the quads. Just people whose knees say yes at everything that they even suggest. That's what you want. People so young, the yoke is still on them. That's what you really want in life. It's like continuation of life. It's the conversation between the old and the young. And that's what keeps us and this human culture growing and evolving. So we've heard from the elders. I think it's important to hear from the young at the same time, at all times, when we're having these conversations.
Fantastic. Well, that is just about what we're going to have. I don't know if he's still got yoke on him, but he's pretty young. Our next guest is Chi Ose. Now, he's joining from New York, where he is the youngest elected member of the city council.
Hi, Chi. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You, in your second term as the youngest council member in New York history.
The youngest elected official in New York State.
Dang. Okay, I'm sorry, boo.
Well done, you. What led you to do that so young, do you think?
Yeah, listen, I never thought I would be in the position that I am today. I always had interest in politics. You know, my parents always raised me to be aware of my surroundings, especially being a Black person in the United States of America. But I distinctly remember Obama winning in 2009. I think it was like 8 or 9 years old, and just being so moved by politics in general, but also this history that I was witnessing as a young person. It wasn't until 2016, when I was 18 years old, where I was able to cast my first vote, and Bernie Sanders was running for president. It was literally the first time that there was an elected official that I was able to vote for, but also someone who was speaking towards the values and beliefs that I held, that my generation held, and it really brought me into the fold of paying attention more than I ever have. I went on to going to college, leaving school, working in nightlife and restaurants. And when the pandemic hit, it completely turned that entire world and industry that I was working in upside down, like everywhere else. And I didn't know what was next in my life until George Floyd was murdered in the May of 2020. And I was in my quarantine. And obviously, I've seen Black folks killed at the hands of law enforcement before. But this was an event that stirred something different in me. And it brought me out of my quarantine to protest, and I started protesting every single day during that summer, started leading some of the largest protests that happened in New York City at the time, and started advocating for changes within policing, as well as a plethora of different issues within New York City, and honed in a lot on the powers of our city government. And when I saw that my city council member didn't vote on our over $100 billion budget in New York City in the way that I would have, I kind of said, fuck it, and decided to run for office myself.
When you look around now that you are in the position that you're in, do you look at the age thing as a factor? Do you look around and go, we need more young people in this space?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, my youth was seen as a setback by, you know, many people when I was first running for office. Folks would say that I was too young or too inexperienced. And, you know, a lot of those critiques could be valid in one way, shape, or form. But I think my honesty, as well as my distance from being within our corrosive bureaucratic governmental system, was something that appealed to a lot of people. And even in my campaign for office, I turned out a record number of young people who never voted in a local city council race before. Right now, while I'm in office, yes, I totally believe that representation matters across the board, whether it's sexual orientation and race and gender, but also age representation. Right, I think a lot of young people are dealing with a multitude of different crises, right? A cost of living crisis, environmental crisis, student debt, right? And those issues are directly impacting young people. So I think that those who are closest to the problems are always the individuals who are closest to the solutions. So yes, I truly do believe that we need younger representation in office, especially given the different crises that this country is facing.
You said something interesting that gets thrown at young people who maybe try to join, and that's you don't have experience. And that can seem like I don't, therefore I can't. I'm like, what are the sort of things that you would tell a younger person to go, in the face of that seems like the end of the conversation? What are the other stuff that they can throw back at that and say, no, I may not have experience, but this is what I can bring to this conversation at this point?
Democracy and voting and government is something that is for everyone. And I think that people try to complicate it by saying you have to do this or that or be this age or look like this to be a part of this. That's not what democracy is. And that's why I truly believe that anyone who wants to run for office, who wants to get involved, should have the opportunity and should have the free will to do so. Even if you're not going to win this race, I think that your voice within, you know, any type of political campaign will raise the issues to a higher level that, even if you don't win, will be in the back of the mind or the front of the mind of the person who becomes your next elected representative.
That's a nice way of thinking, because I suspect some people might be quite daunted for running for office because it's, you know, it sounds quite frightening to actually get into office. But it's lovely to think about just the act of running, you know, the act of speaking and putting yourself forward can make a difference.
You know, when people say you're too inexperienced or too green or too young, my response was always, you know, do you like how things are right now, right? Are you comfortable with how expensive your rent is, the fact that you can't pay for healthcare? Those people who are making those decisions and shaping the way that our world is are those who are experienced, right? Those who have paid their dues, right? Those who set out to do this and worked for a senator here and there, and now they're in that position now. There's this level of complacency that exists within government filled with experienced people that isn't working for so many Americans and so many of my neighbors. And I think that's why I ran for office in the first place. I was sick of the bureaucracy. I was sick of the how complacent and slow our government was moving, while at the same time, folks were patting themselves on the back for the work that they were doing.
When you entered into it, what were the sort of blind spots that were obvious to you, but you just like, is nobody else seeing this? I'd be interested in some examples that you might have where you go, this is what we should be dealing with, or this is how we should be dealing with something that no one else had seen at all.
I think the literal power of the New York City Council, right? And I think that, you know, many people think about, or many people that I interacted with in my run for office think about government and politics on a macro level, right? The president in our United States Congress, when it's like so much deeper than that, right? We need to be voting for the right Democrats across, you know, all levels of government, not just the federal level, but state and local. Now, the city council has three major powers that directly impact the lives of so many New Yorkers. We vote on a $107 billion budget. You know, that's a bigger budget than countries across the world,
yeah,
right?
I keep thinking you're making a mistake when you say that number. I'm like, I think he's adding some billions that shouldn't be there.
Listen, we have Wall Street. It's New York City, right? And this is the money that, you know, affects housing and sanitation and policing and infrastructure and healthcare, right? The very things that impact all of our lives. So many people don't trust democracy and like democracy because they solely vote for, you know, Joe Biden, the president, and our federal elected officials, and then they don't see any effects, you know, within their own communities. My job is, if someone wants a trash can on their corner, I can get a trash can on their corner next week. And that regains trust, you know, between individual and their government and an individual and democracy. And I think that them learning about that process is a beautiful thing to see, but also something that really shocked me in my learning of what my job was in relation to the people that I represent. Young people should be learning about who their representatives are, when they're able to vote, how they could pre-register to vote, what the different levels of government do for them and where they live. This education needs to happen within our public education system and within our American education system as a whole.
It's really ironic, isn't it? I mean, definitely in the UK, there's so many surveys and so much evidence to show that what people really, really care about is literally what happens within a square mile of where they live. You know, they really care about their air quality, parking rights, you know, what's our local school like? And yet they also feel completely disempowered to do anything about it because they see this sort of nonsense at Westminster and friends, you know, giving contracts to other people. And there's this crazy disconnect about what they care about and what they think they can do. And I think that's what you're talking to. I'm really interested to dig into the goals a little bit in your view. Because we all met at dinner in New York talking about how we're going to win the global goals in the second half. And I've got the problem with the goals in many ways is that there's so many of them, you can't win on everything. But I'd love to hear what you think about, as someone who's very much on the ground affecting change for people in your district, the linkage between affordable, accessible, sustainable. You know, so often, again, people are told that that's a choice. What's your view on bringing all those things together so that people have a balanced, better life?
You know, I believe that making cities more livable and urbanizing cities as a whole is a great tool and a tool at my disposal in making this earth greener, right? I think a lot of people live under a misconception that large cities like New York City, like London, are huge pollutants to our world, when cities are polluting less than suburbs, right? There's a concept that seeps its way into policy, and it's called the 15-minute city, right? And it's creating dense urban areas that within a 15-minute walk radius, you can access everything, right? Work, school, education, laundry, groceries, you know, creating these urban centers that are accessible to all people. And I think that creating those dense urban areas through expanding public transportation, through investing within communities, as well as dense housing within those communities, is how we create areas on our planet that are less harmful to our environment than suburbs. And when you see suburbs that are sprawled out around, you know, our natural world, it's using more energy per person. It's using more cars. It's harming the environment more just through landscaping and whatnot. If all of the world's population lived in 30 cities, the world would be a cleaner place and the environment would be much better.
So we're facing our second half of the Global Goals and you're facing your second term. Do you have something that you're focusing on that you go, if nothing else, I really want to get that done?
Yeah. I mean, this is a very New York City issue. There's this weird system we have in New York City where when you're finding housing, you are forced as a tenant to pay a broker fee just to move in. Now, a broker is someone who, I guess, is the middle person between the landlord and the tenant to help them find housing. However, when you're a tenant in New York, you've never met this broker before. You've never negotiated a price with them before. All they do is open the door of the apartment that you're looking for to allow you to come in. And then they charge you a fee of 15 to 20% of your annual rent. So, so many New Yorkers are having, yes, I'm not
kidding.
That's huge. So many, it's ridiculous. I had to pay $10,000 just to move into my apartment. That's multiple paychecks. That's first month, last month, and this broker fee that you have to pay for. This bill that I'm pushing requires that whomever hires a broker has to pay a broker fee. Sounds like common sense to me, right? But what oil is to Texas, real estate is to New York City. Thus, real estate has a lot of interest within our political system. So if this bill passes, it would alleviate a huge pressure off of tenants in New York City, whether you're a single mother living paycheck to paycheck or a young person who just moved here, you know, is working a job with not the best salary, but you really need to find housing. So I guess it is in tangent with, you know, my mission of making cities greener, because if we make cities more livable, we make the world a greener place as well.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely in line with the goals. I mean, just housing people is a huge thing. And as to your point, if we can get more people living in efficient cities, that makes, you know, it's a huge part of greening the world. And that's I hope that bill passes.
How are you going to campaign or lend your brilliant energy to your national election coming up next year to that one?
The world is watching.
What is it you feel that you can do to make a difference there? Because we're counting on you, G. We are counting on you.
Listen, at this, you asked how I cope with everything, and it's because maybe I'm not in national politics yet.
To stay sane.
Yeah, I'm still like enjoying my 20s a little bit, but.
Well, you can't. We need you. Thank you. Oh, look, it's been so nice to see you again. Really best of luck with your agenda for the next, well, till we see you next, which I hope will be soon. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. And you guys take care. Thank you so much.
That's great.
You know, he had a really grounded, common sense attitude, didn't he, about, well, this is what people would want, obviously. This is therefore what I'm going to represent. And he had that a really, apart from being like obviously very clever and grasping all the issues, he had a very straightforward connection, cause and effect. Like, that needs to happen, so I'm going to do this. Well, you were saying earlier, like, there's no room for reasonable. He's reasonable.
No, it's not reasonable to draw a straight line in politics. There's no straight. That's what I meant by you need crazy people like Chi. Chi's crazy. Like, he goes, there's a problem and there's a direct solution. That's not what happens. That's not what we're used to. We're used to bureaucracy and, you know, the actual game of politics before anything happens. You have to be crazy to think that anything's a straight line, to think that you're going to change something that's built in capitalism, like the agents in New York, to think that, oh no, this thing's not good. I'm going to change it. That's a madman's mission.
he's so reasonable. He's mad.
He's mad, really. It's people like him that make you go, the future isn't a write-off. And we need that. That's the importance of youth, is to have the young people that, as an older person, I can look at and go, I think we'll be fine. I think if we just carry on, you know, supporting each other in the good directions that we're trying to do, we'll be fine, because the people with the legs, the young people are jumping on, and they're jumping on with energy and with new ideas, but also kind of getting what the thing actually is, what we actually need and where we actually need to be. That's the kind of thing that gives you more than just hope and optimism. It's kind of proof. Youth is proof.
Youth is proof.
And the wisdom of the old is also proof. It's nice to look at both and go, that does work. And look at the young and go, that will work.
Yeah, that's nice. God, again, you're full of soothsayings today. That's made me think about when we launched the goals in 2015, one of the campaign thoughts we had was the people who are 15 now will be 30 years old when the goals are, in theory, concluded. You know, so you'll go from being a school attendee to really possibly be, well, you'd be older than Chi, right? You'd be older than Chi, so you could be a genuine leader. And I think if the more people that get involved in the second half with the goals now, it doesn't matter how young you are, because everything you can do, everything is a thing. Richard Curtis always says everything is a thing. So it doesn't matter whether you're 15 or 50, it's going to take all of us doing things to get it done. So I think in terms of like politics, what she showed us is that you can start really local and still have a really big impact. And I think people just don't take it enough, like where you live. Like if something's really winding you up about where you live, find out who's in charge of that and change it. Whatever goal you care about, and it could be climate and it could be education and it could be consumption, you know, there will be something you can do about it. You're never too young to start. And then I think Ms. Mary said you can never be too ambitious. Like she's covered the world with peace and justice and all the stuff she's done, but he's like, she's on the block and he's making change happen like right in front of him.
Yeah. And getting involved in politics doesn't mean being a politician. It just means calling them to task. You're calling your leaders to task. And, you know, if there's a pothole that you said, if they said that they're going to close it, stay on their necks. That's being in politics, calling them and making them do their jobs. And it's exciting when you see young people getting involved in that. And, you know, we look at the 15 years, they go by so fast, but not as fast as our 30-second wrap-up. Are you ready for an idiot's guide to saving the world in 30 seconds?
I think so. Okay, let's count us in. 3, 2, 1.
Focus on the end goal.
What if the best is ahead of us?
Yes, that's a great way of looking at it. And the importance of intersectionality.
Indeed, everything affects everything else, including the generations. So let's remember to bring all the generations together in dialogue.
Because it is teamwork after all. Work in a team, more can be achieved that way.
If you put more women in power, it will help us achieve what we all want.
Voting locally can be the most effective way to make change.
If you're not happy with the way things are for you, then you might be just the person to change it. Oh, there she goes.
There were so many learnings. There was no way we were going to get them all in that, but that was a great wrap-up, great episode.
And if you want to find out more about what we're trying to achieve or how you can help, head over to globalgoals.org, where you'll find a whole load more great tips on how you can get involved.
And that's it from now. I am Loyiso Madinga.
And I'm Gail Galley.
See you guys next episode. An Idiot's Guide to Saving the World is an Audi production made in collaboration with Project Everyone.
The producer and sound designer is Holly Fisher. Project Everyone's producers are Imogen Fairburn and Tash Ramsaha. The executive producers are Yelene Goffin and Harry Watson.
If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, share on your socials, and leave a review. It helps other people find us. And the more people find us, the more people are saving the world.